Good afternoon, folks. This is Will Aitchison. I'm with Labor Relations Information System, and we're doing yet another of our series of interviews with leading labor law practitioners around the country. Today, we're thrilled to have with us Gary Lipman. Gary is an attorney in Florida. He works for the Palm Beach County Police Benevolent Association. Gary's background is a very lengthy one in labor relations. He graduated from Vassar College, where he actually was on the men's varsity basketball team, which pretty great accomplishment. He then went to Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. And for those of you unfamiliar with that program, that is probably the leading non-legal labor relations program in the country. Gary got his master's of industrial and labor relations from Cornell and then went on to get his lawyer's degree, Juris Doctor degree, from City University of New York. He's been the general counsel for the PBA in Palm Beach since 2001, so 13 years in the job. And Gary, welcome to this interview. Thanks for agreeing to participate.
I'm flattered that you asked.
Gary, our topic today is perhaps the hottest topic that I've seen in many, many years in public safety labor relations, and it's the topic of body cameras. And this is a topic that just seems to be exploding all over the country. Is that true in Florida?
It's developing, I think, along the same lines as it is nationwide.
And where are you seeing the pushes for body camera policies coming from?
Well, you know, the pushes for body cameras are, I think, obviously emanating from the events in Ferguson and the ready availability of the technology. I'm actually pleased that some of the agencies that we're dealing with are exploring it. They're not running headlong into it. And that the couple of them that I'm aware of have been receptive thus far to my request for bargaining with regard to these matters. We haven't gotten into the bargaining stage yet. I think most of the agencies that are giving this serious consideration, and I think most are hesitant at the outset based on costs. And then are going to begin the process of figuring out how these things are going to work before they actually come to the table to negotiate. But we have at least one department here that has formed a committee in West Palm Beach and the West Palm Beach Police Department, and they've met a few times about it. I think they're in the process of running some trials. I don't believe as yet anybody's been equipped with any of them. But, you know, the technology is, as you know well, not really all that novel. The tasers that our sheriff's office uses, most of them have video recording. And so the officers have been, I think, begun to become accustomed to having video of their actions.
Now, I wanted to focus in this interview perhaps not so much about some of the very obvious policy considerations attendant to body camera policies, things like when do you turn them on and when do you turn them off, in terms of the privacy of those whose images are captured on the body camera, those sorts of like big questions. I wanted to focus, at least to start with, on the bargaining implications of these policies. Now, Florida is a collective bargaining state for public safety employees, right?
Correct.
You have a system that I would describe it as kind of a meet and confer system, where if you can't reach agreement, there is an option to go through sort of a, I think of it as kind of a quirky special master process. Is that right?
Yes, actually, they've changed the name of the arbiters from special master to special magistrate. No substantive difference in the proceedings that I've noticed over the years. And it is a procedure that has all the outward appearances of what I was familiar with in New York as binding arbitration. It has all those outward appearances, but it ultimately concludes with what's called a recommended decision by the special magistrate. And then that recommended decision is subject of the employers and the unions' rejections, sort of exceptions that you file to the findings and to the recommendations. And then it ultimately, unless the parties agree, it goes to the legislative body, a city commission or a county commission. The legislative body in the jurisdiction, and they're required to hold a hearing, but they can resolve the impasse however they see fit.
I was just going to say, in the end, the employer can unilaterally implement something in the end of the Florida process, right?
Absolutely, it's an interesting system. Because it is far more political than any other I've ever had any experience with. So if you've got the standard 5-member city municipal commission and the union can be assured of 3 votes, you pretty much get the better part of what you're looking to negotiate. If you don't have the 3 votes, then you don't. So it's a far more politicized process than any I've ever experienced, and the interesting thing is I think as the PBA, and the PBA has really been in the forefront statewide of political and legislative activities. I had made a prediction a few years ago, and I think the change in the economy thwarted that. But as a firefighter and police unions became more effective politically, and the tides started to turn in these legislative bodies, I kind of anticipated that there would be a hue and cry for a binding arbitration model as opposed to what we have here. But that hasn't materialized, and a good deal of the PBAs and other union political activities have really been blunted as they have nationwide.
Now, this bargaining process that you describe, a period of negotiations followed by potentially special magistrate proceedings, followed potentially by the action of the governmental body, implementation of something, does that bargaining process apply when an employer wants to make a midterm change, mid-contract change, in something that's mandatory for bargaining, a wage hour negotiable working condition issue?
Well, you know, I think the process is not much unlike others here in Florida. If there is an intention to make a change, the union can request bargaining. I don't buy into the what I consider to be a kind of mobilization of bias in the language of collective bargaining that has employers are always offering things. Offers are so nice. I mean, you can take it or leave it, whereas unions are always characterized as demanding things. I don't demand bargaining, but if we are advised, we hear of an intended change to something that's going to affect wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment, we request bargaining. And if the employer is willing to bargain, we bargain. If they unilaterally make the change, we file an unfair labor practice. But if it is a subject that is covered by our collective bargaining agreement, and the employer wants to change, we're not under any obligation to agree to a change. And in that regard, there's always that that kind of parallel coexistent option to file a grievance. And there have been occasions where changes were made to either an FTO program or assignments of certain personnel that were subject of a collective bargaining agreement, where we actually went on both tracks, filing an unfair labor practice because under Chapter 447 Florida statutes here, which is our labor law, an employer has to give the union, the labor organization, notice and an opportunity to bargain with regard to those things. And frequently we don't get notice, but when we do, we typically request bargaining. I have a standard form advising the employer that, you know, while they may have already committed an unfair labor practice or a grievance, we'd like to sit down and talk with them about it.
And what is it that a labor union would want to bargain about a body camera policy? Say the employer is toying with implementing a policy, perhaps on a trial basis, perhaps not even on a trial basis, just toying with having all uniformed officers wear a body camera. What would a union want to bargain about that?
Well, I had occasion actually to look at the LRIS model policy, and you know, to the extent that officers are going to be held accountable for the operation, for the maintenance of them, and the like, I tend to draw a line between the policies which employers can promulgate, and we want to be part of that process. But what we also want, and I think more appropriately in a contract, is a limit on the extent to which these things can intrude on officers' confidential and private issues. The right of privacy in Florida is in its constitution, and it's actually a more powerful one than I've seen anywhere. It's in Article 1, Section 23, and it talks about how people have a right to be let alone and free from governmental intrusion into their private life. And to the extent that we have now in-car audio recordings, now we're going to be having body cams. There's GPS that arguably, in fact, from a practical standpoint, as a public record, can identify where officers live if they use their assigned vehicles to drop their children off at schools, where their kids go to school, where their doctors are, where they worship on Sunday, if they or on Saturday, if they have personal uses of these vehicles, and some of our departments do. These are things that the legislature also needs to catch up to, because Florida also has a very, very powerful, actually it's a powerful tool and a very good thing in terms of its public records law, far more user-friendly, far more open, and in the absence of an express exemption under that statute, all of this is public record. And what we'd like to negotiate, certainly, is some limitation on the extent to which things that are not law enforcement related that may be captured in these recordings, that those things are going to be exempt as best we can, and we're going to need the cooperation of friendly legislators. And we also want to ensure that in situations where officers' judgment is subject to investigation, that these things don't substitute for the officer's perspective at the time, and those are subjective. They're subject of the Graham v. Connor standard, and one of the things that had bothered me when I first had heard about an agency that was considering them was a certain police chief's identification of the camera that's affixed to the eyeglasses as being ideal for capturing the officer's perspective. And I found that also in the police executive research forum study, which I think overall was a good one on body-worn camera programs. But they also use that term, capturing the officer's perspective. And I think in that regard, what we'd want to negotiate is an understanding that while those things may well be and properly are evidence of an incident of an officer's conduct, that they're not going to be substituting for the officer's subjective perspectives and the officer's judgment. We don't have to do much in the way of negotiating officers' access to these things. We're very fortunate in Florida to have what's the shorthand is called Police Officers and Correctional Officers Bill of Rights. And over the years, there have been a number of amendments, the last of which was in July of 2009, that it affords subject officers the opportunity, together with counsel, to review videos, GPS, vehicle locator information in advance of being questioned about those things. But to the extent that the body-worn cameras now are appearing to be soon part of the equipment that our members are going to be required to wear, we're concerned. At least I've been concerned about one of the brands has a 30-second, they call it a reach back. I think you're probably familiar with the dash cams going back a minute, and there's some concerns that we have about what it may capture that is absolutely unrelated to the law enforcement activity. But right now there is no statutory exemption for any of those things. So I think, and I'd like to think, that our law enforcement employers would share a community of interest with their officers and with their officers' labor representatives in ensuring that things that are personal and confidential aren't unnecessarily bared into the public record.
So I want to take apart the various pieces of what you just said. I heard you say, first of all, look, there's real privacy interests for officers that we're concerned with. We're concerned not just about something as basic as, is the body camera on when the officer is in the locker room or in a restroom, or when the officer is engaged in a conversation with another officer in a non-enforcement situation. We're obviously concerned with all of those things, and we're concerned that these cameras may be capturing either images or sound in matters that are private, that have nothing whatsoever to do with any enforcement action. But you also bring up a point, frankly, I hadn't thought about before, and that is that in Florida and in other states, a number of officers have take-home vehicles. And depending upon how these body camera policies are written, there may be a lot of personal information disclosed by the use of the vehicle before and after the work shift. I think that's an interesting point. Haven't heard that before, Gary.
Well, the sheriff's office, as an example here, the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, is, I think, one of the top 10 or 11 largest sheriff's offices in the nation. Officers living in Palm Beach County have free, unlimited personal use with some limitations in terms of drinking establishments and the like, but they have otherwise unlimited use of the assigned vehicles for personal use. Those things already contain GPS, and they are a wealth of information that is entirely unrelated to law enforcement. And those kinds of things, the body cams may be less so, but nonetheless another opportunity to capture things that that may be unrelated to the law enforcement activity. But I think primarily the focus narrowly on body cams is that they not be the end all determinant with regard to an officer's conduct. We had, after the last amendments to the statute governing law enforcement and correctional officers' interrogations back in July of 2009, that was the before the political landscape changed here, those amendments established a requirement that my members be provided videos, onboard videos, any recordings, GPS and the like, all of which were responsive. That legislation was responsive to experiences we had had and I had had as a PBA attorney with agencies possessing those things in their investigative files but refusing to allow my clients and me to review them. And it was a fairly frequent occasion where we'd know there was, for example, a gas station or a convenience store video of an incident, and we would ask to see them, and we were told, well, the statute doesn't require us to provide that. And those conversations usually went in circles. I'd ask, where is there a statute that prohibits those things from being provided? And I was pretty frequently told, nice try, but they weren't going to show it to us. Well, after the amendments in 2009, there really was a kind of equal and opposite reaction and a pioneering of I don't even want to call it investigative procedures by which discipline could result from an allegation of misconduct without ever questioning the subject officer, because virtually all of the rights that are in this Bill of Rights are animated at or about the time of the interrogation. And what some employers found was that they could pretty much do an end run around those rights by just never questioning the officer. And I think the biggest prospect, the biggest threat to that kind of quick connecting of the dots between the allegation of misconduct and the discipline is with body cams and a discussion that begins with the articulated in one case belief that it gives the officer's perspective, and my concern is that there really won't much be a need from some agency standpoints to hear what the officer had to say.
I find that absolutely fascinating, because I mean, you talk to the human factors experts out there in the country, people like, well, down in your neighborhood, Daryl Ross at Valdosta State University in Georgia, or Bill Lewinsky up in Minnesota. You talk to those folks, and they will say about body cameras, they'll say anybody who thinks that a body camera is capturing the officer's perspective of an issue is just simply flatly wrong, and wrong at many levels. Body cameras don't track the officer's eyes, for example. They don't have the same depth of field. They don't have the same kind of width of perception that the officer might have. They are 2D images versus 3D images. They capture lighting differently than the officer sees. They don't capture non-visual clues that the I could go on and on and on. And you see these human factors experts weighing in as clearly as they could, saying, I think what you're saying, Gary, which is the images and the sounds from a body camera, that's one piece of evidence. But don't let anybody be misled into thinking that that is a dispositive piece of evidence. It's simply one piece of the equation. And I hear you saying that's one of the things that you want to be able to bargain when you're sitting down at the table with a body camera policy.
As best we can, but the, you know, and I think you you absolutely identified what is a really initial mission for labor representatives, for unions and union lawyers, which is, unfortunately, I think, educating the public with regard to that, and especially where there are cases that I think fairly can be characterized as extreme, it's difficult under those circumstances to generate any light with all the heat. But the talking with employers about these kinds of things, who are also driven by some of the popular public opinions on these things, is also a challenge. And some of the things you identified, I mean, an officer's familiarity with a suspect, the nature of the call, the nature of the calls that have involved a particular suspect, may occasion an officer putting a hand on a suspect's shoulder that might not otherwise be something that he or she would do with some other kind of suspect with whom they have less experience, and that can be seen as provoking an encounter. There are any number of things. I mean, among the experts that you identified, I had occasion years ago to work with Thomas Avini out of the Police Policy Studies Council up in New Hampshire, and he had helped me prepare to go into a grand jury with an officer who had shot and killed a young man in an incident. And, these are people who are somewhat expert in what happens with law enforcement officers when they're in these kinds of situations, and especially deadly force situations, the auditory exclusion, the tunnel vision, the things that I think may popularly be received as excuses are really part and parcel with an explanation for the conduct from the officer's perspective. And I think the real challenge, because I think employers, at least some of those that I've been dealing with, not all, but some, I think, have a reflexive response to a union proposal, and it's a reflexive kind of resistance, and I think that's unfortunate. We have to get past that, and I think getting employers to recognize that we do share a community of interest around how these images, these sounds that are being captured, are going to be interpreted and applied, because there are, by its very nature, when you're looking at a video, it's that 20/20 hindsight that the Supreme Court had talked about in Graham v. Connor. By their very nature, it's after the fact. And that's a kind of hindsight that affords people the luxury of second guessing the people I represent on decisions that they didn't have that luxury.
Well, Gary, I've taken too much of your time already. I thank you very much for being willing to talk to us. One of the things we're going to do is we will post the Florida Bill of Rights online. Most states don't have a clause. First of all, most states don't have Peace Officer Bill of Rights. And those that do typically do not have the sort of specific provision you talked about, where officers have the right to access to things like photographic images, body camera images, and the like before they write a report. In most states, that's going to be the first topic for bargaining, I suspect, for police unions. Can we see these things before we write a report or give a statement about the use of deadly force? So we're in this anomalous situation where, at least relatively, Gary, Florida's better off than the rest of the country from the standpoint of police unions. I don't use that phrase very often.
I need to distinguish. Our officers don't necessarily have that right before they write a report. There's kind of a colloquy that needs to go on that my members are often reluctant to initiate, which is, you know, is what I'm going to write. Could this result in some discipline? And you know, that's a difficult thing to do when a sergeant or a superior officer says, I need a report. Those rights in the police officers and correctional officers' Bill of Rights are really animated when an officer indisputably is going to be subject of discipline, potentially, and is being interrogated, and that's the word, interrogated, with regard to the incident subject of the investigation. So, but when it comes to writing reports and the like, that's a gray area not covered by the statute, and unless an officer is willing to risk, if not a charge of insubordination, at least a challenge to how promptly they're complying with a direct order, in order to say, you know, well, wait a second, if I write this report, is this something that might result in discipline? And so, you know, what we're trying to do is to establish that contractually in a way that's analogous to what would be a more formal setting in internal affairs.
So there's yet one more bargaining issue for you. Well, Gary, thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate your participation in this interview.
My pleasure, Will. Thank you.
Okay. Have a good day, Gary.
You too.